Okay.
Probably they gave birth in that bed.
That's also true. That's right. That's also right. Now, we continue on 115b1, first paragraph on the left side, first real paragraph that begins. Avel asur ba'asiyat menacha. The mourner is prohibited to do labor, to engage in work. Dichtiv, and the source is a fascinating source from the Book of Amos. Dichtiv ve'hafachti chageichem le'evel, and I shall turn your festivals over into mourning. Now, this is part of a period, a piece of the Book of Amos, where there is a threat of what the retribution will be like, and that will have to be borne by the people if they continue their sinful ways. And as the prophet brings God's word about this, God says, "V'afachti chageichem le'evel, I shall turn your joyful times, your festivals, into periods of mourning." And the Gemara goes on and says, "Af dichtiv hafachti chageichem le'evel, ma'achag asur b'malacha, as milacha is prohibited on a festival." Af avel asur b'malacha. So a mourner is forbidden to engage in work. Now this is an argument that, frankly, is not what I would call a logical argument. It's an argument based on the fact that in a verse, you have one half the verse says chag, and the other half of the verse says evel, and they're both in the same verse. And therefore, there seems to be a connection between them. What you do or don't do on your chag will be what you do or you don't do on in your mourning, exactly. So, as I say, I don't think it's particularly logical the way we had, for example, in the Book of Ezekiel, where it says, you shall wear your shoes. Or we saw that in the Torah, in the Book of Leviticus, where it says, Bigdechem alti fromo, do not rend your garments. And we learned opposite, because the prophet Ezekiel was told that he should not do something, we learned that everybody else should do it. Because Aaron was told that he is not allowed to rend his garment, we learned that everybody else has to rend his garment. That's a logical argument based on biblical verses. This is an argument that rather is a gzerah shavah. This is two things that are juxtaposed, and that too occasionally becomes the source of rabbinic exegesis. And I think that the psychology, number one, is very interesting. The psychology is chag. Chag, by the way, is not just the festival day. And that will become actually crucial for the discussion of what we mean by the word milacha, what the labor is that is prohibited here. Because on a chag, there are many things that you cannot do, like cooking. Well, you can cook, but you couldn't turn on the fire if it weren't from something that was already lit. So a lot of details of a festival, and you wonder because of this whether that's what we're talking about. And the fact is that's not what we're talking about. We are talking ultimately about the laws of Chol HaMoed. The laws of Chol HaMoed, and there is prohibited work on Chol HaMoed. And that generally has to do with what you would call your work. Right? Professional type of work. The laws of Chol HaMoed revolve around that kind of labor, as opposed to the Sabbath labors, which are, by extension, the Yom Tov labors, all of which are derived from the labors that were involved in the building of the Mishkan. So the Sabbath system and the Yom Tov system is a symbolic system. It doesn't really have to derive from everyday experience. Labor on the Sabbath has nothing to do with what you or I might call labor. It has everything to do with the labors that were a part of the building of the Mishkan. Okay? What?
The 39 melachot.
The 39 melachot, correct. But when we talk about this labor, it's different. This is what you and I would generally call labor. This is your work, which is the kind of thing that's prohibited on Chol HaMoed. Okay, so that from a philological perspective is what we're talking about by the meaning of melacha, and I'll say more about that in a moment. But in addition, think about the psychology here. The psychology of the statement is very interesting, of Amos, because what it is saying is that almost what we've seen here in this chapter, this is a chapter that is in a masechet about Chol HaMoed. And we've seen that the laws of Chol HaMoed are like the laws of mourning. Right? On Chol HaMoed, we had an issue of haircutting. On Chol HaMoed, we had an issue of washing the clothes. And those, in fact, were issues as far as mourning goes as well. So, interestingly enough, here you have a biblical verse. If I was going to say that there was one verse that was sort of the verse of the chapter, this is the verse from Amos. And the psychology there is very profound, because the psychology is the very things that you do to manifest joy are the same things that you do to manifest grief. It's a very odd thing, because it's not hard to imagine that they should be completely different. But the symbolic system here is that you have the same actions for opposite purposes. Opposite purposes. You know, absolutely opposite purposes. And therefore you sense the power of the connection made by Amos, as understood by the rabbis, that in fact the things that bring you joy, those exact things, a little bit of a switch can be filled with grief. Filled with grief. And that's the nature of the system. Then the symbolic system that you're dealing with doesn't have meaning of them by itself, because the same symbols can mean opposite things, completely opposite things depending upon the circumstance.
In the verse in Amos, it says in that pasuk, it says "V'samtiha ke'evel yachid." Does this figure also into what we're talking about?
Yeah, it's the same idea. Evel yachid, correct? Because he's now speaking to the people at large, and he's saying to them, "Your day of joy, I shall make into the individual's mourning." In other words, the symbols, the way an individual mourns, is what's going to happen to your day of joy. That's the punishment that is coming to you. Okay? So it's very strong. And the force of it is that labor is prohibited. Labor is prohibited. Now, I wanted to say a little bit more about that and introduce you. We privately had some conversations about this, but I wanted to introduce you to what is the most important book for Jewish mourning for any American Jew. Because it is in English, and it's very accessible English. It's intelligent English. It's not complicated. It's down to earth. It's filled with reasonable explanations. And that is Rabbi Maurice Lamb's book, The Jewish Way in Death and Mourning. This has become essentially a classic. I'm not sure that I can think of any other book that's had that place in American Jewish life. Rabbi Lamb wrote this. Now, this is not the Rabbi Lamb who is the president of Yeshiva University, was the president of Yeshiva University. This is his brother. His brother was a rabbi for many years on the West Coast, and it was while he was a rabbi in Los Angeles that he wrote this, The Jewish Way in Death and Mourning. It's available today in paperback. Any Jewish bookstore has it in paperback. Barnes & Noble probably also has it. There you go. There you go. That's the paperback. And it, Lamb, L-A-M-M, Maurice Lamb. I keep this right by my desk because obviously in my line of work I have to answer questions very frequently. And I also have to go over things before a period of holidays, let's say. one of the most difficult things is to remember the laws of the holidays. And I, frankly, before every holiday, I read this over again to fix in my mind, because I never know what's going to happen. Suddenly something will happen, and I have to be, I have to answer a question on my toes. So always go over with this, go over in this book. And there's just nothing that is as straightforward and as accessible. Now, as a good example of this, here's a section in here on working and conducting business while you're a mourner. Now, again, what that means is you're a mourner. That means that you are halachically a mourner, one of the close relatives that will make you a mourner has died. Remember that again, that's a spouse or a child or a parent or a sibling. The mourning has been triggered. And here he writes about working and conducting business. One of the most fundamental laws of Jewish mourning, over 3,000 years old, and later recorded by the prophet Ezekiel, here in one of his rare, and I can't imagine this was his mistake. This must have been the printer's. It was Amos. It says Ezekiel, and it's Amos. It was Amos. I'm interested. Saul, in your edition, look up, see if the pagination is... Oh, so look on page 113. See if the pagination is the same to begin with. But I wonder whether they corrected that, because... This is the first edition that I have. Yes. It's from years ago.
The second paragraph, thus the prophet Ezekiel.
Oh, Ezekiel? It's, okay.
Well, nobody's read it.
So,
you're the only person that's read
it. It's like the Amish when they make a quilt, they leave one error.
Or it's like those of you have been to my house in Jerusalem know that our custom in Jerusalem is we leave part of the wall undone. Zecher lechorban. And it's written there, Zecher lechorban, to remember the destruction of the temple.
That's what I keep wanting to do in a synagogue. Is there a part of this synagogue that commemorates that?
Oh, it's all over.
What was his latest book of Norris Lamb? Just published, 90 years old.
A new one,
fantastic, but I can't remember.
I remember.
I remember him 50 years ago, he was a rabbi in Jamaica.
Okay. Judaism, unlike many ancient and some modern cultures, endows labor with dignity and considers commerce a proper activity of man. However, never must work so dominate a man that he becomes a mere cog in society's wheel. The dimensions of a man's personality must include his labor or business or career, but must transcend them as well. He must be able to experience life's great moments as an authentic human being and not restrict his horizon to that of a laborer or professional. Hence, Judaism demands that at moments of great joy or great grief, both of which require concentration and undisturbed meditation, we refrain from our daily pursuits. Mm. And very thoughtful. And here, you see what he's doing is that he is putting the context of Amos, he's developing this argument based on the verse in Amos. Okay? Thus, the prophet Ezekiel should be Amos, records the words of the Lord, and I will transform your festivals to mourning. And the sages taught, as on festivals labor is prohibited, so in days of mourning. That's just what we read. He's now quoting our Gemara. The work prohibition during mourning is not similar to that of the Sabbath, but to that of Chol HaMoed, the intermediary days in the midst of the festivals of Pesach and Sukkot. Of course, the tradition accurately and wisely noted the different motivations for the work prohibition on festivals and during mourning, and these differences are reflected in the laws of Avilut. following on the basic laws of the work prohibition during Shiva. We must realize that because of the many possible situations and the variety of personal and business obligations, the decision of a rabbi may be required in some instances. There are a number of contingencies in this law, and only a competent, learned authority can weigh the human need and the religious requirement in order to make a valid decision. Generally, the law states that one may not do any manner of skilled or unskilled labor, or manage any business enterprise, or direct any investment of monies by himself or through agents for all the days of Shiva. Okay? Included in this prohibition are all those who are dependents of the mourner and his domesticated help, whether they are Jewish or Gentile. That is to say, that you could appoint them to do your labor. You're not allowed to do that. They can't do your business.
So if you have a business...
A child of a mourner who is not himself mourning, even if he is past the age of bar mitzvah, may work during Shiva, but only if the profits go to the child, not to the parent. Those who are economically independent of the father are not affected by the Shiva restrictions. Right? That's key. If the mourner is an employee, either a manager, executive, craftsman, or laborer, he may employ another person to work in his behalf. The employer is not expected to suffer because of the bereavement of an employee. Right? That's the issue. You can, just because you're bereaved, no reason why your employer should suffer. So they can hire someone, or you could pay somebody to do the work that has to be done. Likewise, a mourner, if he's a tenant farmer, I'll skip that, there are not too many tenant farmers around here. If the mourner is an employer,
professional football player.
If the mourner is an employer, the employees should be allowed to work during their owner's observance of Shiva. They are considered to be working for their own profit, even though the mourner profits thereby as well. Generally, you will see that in the laws of mourning, the laws of mourning tend to be lenient. And they surely are lenient where it concerns other people other than the mourner. They are usually lenient. When there's any question in mourning, it's usually you take the lenient position toward the mourner. How much more so for the person who is perhaps unfavorably affected by that individual's mourning. If the mourner has contracted work to others before the death occurred, well, there's all kinds of details here. Retail stores must be closed during Shiva under all ordinary circumstances. It's partnerships. A physician may attend to those of his patients who need his personal service during the Shiva, even if other physicians are available. A physician is usually an exception to the laws. You'll see other things, but we'll get to that. Of course, the doctor should use his discretion as to whether or not it is important enough to make the house call. The first edition, is that in your edition? This book needs to be edited for more than one reason.
Must be from the time of Ezekiel.
Correct. If there is any doubt in his mind, the physician should definitely attend to his patient. That is always the case with the doctor-patient relation. On Yom Kippur, it's the same thing. When there's a doubt, it's always the physician has to be concerned about the patient. The patient always comes first.
But pikuach nefesh, no?
Yep. Even if it's not pikuach nefesh. This is even a case that's less than pikuach nefesh. This is not only life-saving issues. This is whatever the physician has to do for the patient. If the mourner was engaged in his business, when is work permitted? There are cases which, by their very nature, must be considered as exceptions to the normal rules of mourning because of the severe hardship that may be entailed. He then goes into the discussion of people who are poor. And somebody who is so poor that if he doesn't work, he won't have enough food to eat. So if a person really has a necessity to work, you, of course, you can work. Ideally, the community should take care of that person. That wouldn't be. It should be that way, but what if it isn't?
Some people might get fired if they take off.
That could be, correct. That could be, definitely could be. If there is no possibility of his receiving charitable assistance, he may work even on the very first day. With a poor person, what you try to do is you say, you cut it down from 7 to 3 days of mourning. If you have to, you do 3 days. And then if it's still an impossible burden for somebody, even the first day of mourning, the person can work. Severe loss. Not only poverty, but also incurring a severe business loss is grounds for exemption from the prohibition of work during Shiva. It's a very interesting loophole. Understandably, each person will tend to evaluate the extent of his loss subjectively. The deeply grieved may look lightly upon the possibility of losing employment. Those who are grieving mildly may consider a half week's wages a major setback. The judgment in such a situation should therefore be measured by a religious authority. So the law here is that because it's so subjective, you need an objective opinion in order to make the decision. The following matters will be taken into consideration. Will the mourner lose trade to competitors if the store is closed? 2. Does the Shiva fall during one's busy season?
During Christmas. Well,
not if you're a rabbi. Are the goods that will remain unsold because of the observance perishables? Is it possible that they may be rendered non-merchandisable or lose value after the Shiva? Will the purchase price of materials that may not be acquired during Shiva rise if the purchase is delayed? Is there a possibility of losing a job if the mourner does not work for the entire week? Will employees have to be paid while they sit idle while the employer is mourning? Will rented items, such as delivery trucks, have to be paid for, although they will not be used? Will the cessation of business activity cause an irretrievable loss of capital investment? Will there be a major loss of profit if business is not conducted? The rabbi will decide differently. For example, if one is an investor in his spare time for additional income and the loss is mild, or if he derives his major income from investments and thus faces a major financial crisis.
One of the ever been asked to adjudicate such a situation?
Sure. Yeah.
Are these examples, his examples?
No, these are all text-based. This is a long history in this. This is, as with any legal system, you're reading the beginning of it. This is the end of it. And there's a lot between the beginning and the end. But the key issue here is that labor has to do with the laws of Chol HaMoed. Right? And on Chol HaMoed, although this is not very much honored in our environment, laws of Chol HaMoed do prohibit normal labors. Public need. I wanted you to hear this one. Public need. Personal mourning should also not intrude on the conduct of public affairs. Thus, the Talmud guards against the cessation of public Torah studies when the teacher is required to observe Shiva at home. It insists that another person teach in his stead, and if that is not possible, it requires the mourner to perform his normal duties. Public need, thus, received priority, and any disruption of this need was considered an exceptional contingency. In the category of public need are included the following. 1, the sexton of the synagogue, if he is personally needed to arrange the sanctuary and prepare for the Sabbath, or care for the burial of the dead in the burial society. And there is no other person who can function in his stead. Right? If there is, it's different. The teacher of religious studies, if there is no available substitute, should not dismiss classes during Shiva, but should continue teaching himself. If this can be done in his home, it is preferable. This does not apply to the teacher of secular subjects. 3, the shochet, a religious slaughterer of a small community which depends on him for daily meat, may perform his duties after the third day so that the community need not go without meat on the Sabbath. If there is no other shochet, he may go back to work even during the first 3 days. The rabbi, in his professional capacity, may decide points of religious law during Shiva if there is no other available rabbi who can decide these matters. If there is a wedding ceremony at which there will be no music played, and if he is the only qualified person available, he may perform the ceremony in an as inconspicuous and quiet a fashion as possible. A scribe may write a Jewish bill of divorce if there is a possibility that one of the couple may otherwise renege on the agreement, or that the proceedings may be disrupted because of his absence. The moel for the circumcision and the kohen for the ceremony of Pidyon HaBen should likewise perform their respective duties if there is no substitute, as noted above. Public officials who are personally indispensable at the time of Shiva may perform their duties if they can find no adequate replacement. Similarly, military personnel, policemen, and firemen, during times of emergency when their participation is necessary for the public good, may perform their duties during Shiva. It cannot be reiterated often enough that the decision to curtail the practice of Shiva may not be made by laymen or well-wishers or knowledgeable relatives.
Or quotes around knowledgeable.
Correct. Or religious functionaries or funeral directors, but by duly ordained rabbis, thoroughly steeped in the law and aware of the problems of the day. Okay? So I think this is a good insight into the scope and the detail, the requirements and the exceptions that fall under the general definition of prohibited work during Shiva.
Especially in the agricultural society. How about feeding animals?
That too. Perfectly. If there's nobody else to do it. Now, my experience has been, frankly, that in our society, this is hardly ever a problem. There is always someone else. With the possible exception of the physician, once in a while, the rabbi is in this position. The rabbi can be in that position, but a cantor can be in that position. There are communities where cantors are in that position because nobody can lead the services. So the chazan, in effect, will work during the time of Shiva. But generally speaking, most jobs, the possible exception of the physician, most jobs people are able to not perform. And we live in a society which is nurturant about those things. Today, as opposed to 75 years ago, sometimes you will find that a Christian employer will be far more sympathetic and cognizant even than a Jewish employer. Although in this area, frankly, I've never found a Jewish employer. I never got a complaint about a Jewish employer as well. I've often heard that as far as Sabbath observance goes. People will often say you're much better off working for a Gentile if you're a Sabbath observer than for a Jew. That Gentiles will have more patience for Sabbath observance than will Jews. Jews are intolerant of Sabbath observance if they themselves are not Sabbath observant people. So I'm sure many of you have had experiences like this, but we have found that as far as the laws of Shiva go, though this is interesting, I've never really had to deal with too many problems in this area. In many other areas, I get a lot of questions. Not much in this area.
If Lamb were writing about what you're supposed to do on Chol Moed, not for a mourner, would he write it the same way?
You mean the style of writing?
No.
The same context.
Same directives.
Same standards. Yes.
Leanings.
If he were writing about Chol Moed?
Right.
Yeah. The labels that are not supposed to do on Chol Moed, would it be the same
More close. They're very close.
Except then you wouldn't be able to have somebody else fill in your shoes.
Well, depends. It might, because they're Gentiles. These laws are different in a world where you have a lot of Gentiles.
If somebody is a mourner and he feels good by doing something creative other than mourn the old tradition way, he's allowed to do it?
Most cases, yes. Most cases.
Somebody is in mourning and instead of sitting and just feel bad about himself, he wants to do something like painting or to do something.
Yeah, because that's not like the laws of the Sabbath. You know, if the person were a painter and that were his livelihood, I would say he shouldn't do it.
Not about livelihood, just but if you were, himself through correct. His skills.
If that, it's a way of you know, knitting or painting or whatever it is that sort of calms you down, it's not a problem. Not a problem. The only thing that I would say you have to be careful of is music. Music is in a different category. Music is by its nature seems so inappropriate to mourning that music is normally excluded entirely, even if it be the kind of thing you do with your normal life. Many of us listen to music as a way of, you know, background music, a way to calm down, things like that. Music is in a special category as far as mourning goes. And it's frowned upon.
So a musician cannot play his music.
Yeah, but a regular person can't. I mean, even the music on the radio. My radio is tuned to WQXR, let's say. You know, one of my buttons goes there, one of my buttons goes to WNYC. You know, you don't do that during mourning.
But is that a matter, a function of being uplifting? Is that the thing? What is it you don't want from
music? We'll get to, when we get to music, there are a lot of laws about music. Music is in a special category. We still don't do it. Because music is, there's a certain entertainment value to music, which seems inappropriate to mourning. And that's why music is, the prohibitions on music extend throughout a year.
Yeah.
For a parent, when you are mourning for a parent, that's a year of mourning, and the most obvious thing that you can't do is music.
What about liturgy?
Is that from before or after?
Liturgy is different. Liturgy is not music.
Is that before or after?
It depends, but if you're talking about the Sabbath liturgy or the Yom Tov liturgy, it's not. But if you're going to a concert of liturgy...
No, I'm talking about the service.
That's fine.
Does this go back from before Hellenic influence?
Well...
Because Plato had a big thing to write about the danger of music. I mean, it was essentially outlawed from utopia because it was so dangerous.
Seductive.
So I was just wondering if part of this is somehow connected to...
I don't remember offhand. When we get to it in the text, we'll see what the verses are that he used.
I just wanted to add a personal footnote to your general comments about Rabbi Lam's book, because actually it's one of the reasons I decided to take the class this year, is that my father died about 15 years ago, right after I joined Or Zeruah, and when I got up from Shiva, my first Shabbos back in Shul, I went to my duly ordained rabbi, and I said... And I think I'd like to come talk to you because I've been reading Rabbi Lam's book and I can't figure out all of what I should be doing for the next year. And Rabbi Wexler's response was, well, if you're telling me that you're reading Rabbi Lam and you're confused, I can see that you're reading him very carefully because it's very hard to pull all this stuff together. And, I mean, it was so true. But it is an incredibly readable and just interesting book.
As you illustrate now, you usually have to talk this over with a rabbi because it's not as if this easily answers all your questions. Because as you can see, he's dealing in subtleties. And so you have to really deal with somebody else who's close to you, who's on your wavelengths when you're going through this. Very frequently, it's an enormous help to do that.
Yeah. I just wanted to say that it seems doubly sad to me that an impoverished mourner has to work, because not only is this person impoverished, but also I think anybody that's in this category, you know, doesn't get the benefit of Shiva, And it is. It must be very difficult to have to work when you're in this emotional condition. So I think that it's a great kind of deprivation not to engage in Shiva and to have to, I guess it depends on the relationship, but I think for most people they need the cessation. It's very difficult to concentrate.
The rabbis considered poverty one step away from death.
Yeah.
We do not have a religion that praises poverty. And to them, poverty was one of the worst things that could ever happen to you. It's one step from death.
It seems to also be a maybe this is a projection, but there also seems to be a bit of a tension between what's being done to aid the mourner and what's being done to ensure that the public appearances and the standards are preserved.
Mm-hmm.
In a decorous way, meaning that you wouldn't want somebody doing something that looks inappropriate for a mourner, even if that turned out to be psychologically very good for mm-hmm. that individual.
Oh, that is true.
Because you wouldn't want to now set a precedent for community behavior
correct. That
might look inappropriate. So it seems like there's some sort of balance going mm-hmm. on between those two.
That's exactly right. It's definitely true. That all this is functioning.
Is mourning exclusively for the mourner, or is mourning also still in part for the deceased?
Hmm. In part, it's for the deceased, but in very small part. It's mostly
that,
for the mourner.
That relates in part
to yes, that's also relevant. That's correct. That's correct.
It's a third party.
That's correct. And it's probably party number three in the order that you gave. And I think your order is correct, and probably this is number three.
A reaction to what Bobby said, as difficult as it is, at least the rabbi can reassure the person who has to go back to work that it's okay in terms of Jewish law.
That you don't go back with guilt.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
What is the tie-in with mourning and the neshama?
Mm-hmm. That's sort of what Terry was saying, because that's the deceased, right? That's the deceased. And here in the Talmud, you'll see really no tie-in with that at all. It's really post-Talmudic that you will see that, because particularly by the time of the Middle Ages, the life of the soul and what the soul is doing during that period of time becomes a concern of Jewish thinkers. So that, for example, in the Kabbalah, we have this idea that it takes the deceased fully 7 days for the soul, the neshama, to free itself of the body. A neshama is attached to a body for 7 days.
So why would bury immediately? Why would not wait 7 days?
Because this whole process begins from the time of burial.
Oh, okay.
From the time of burial. So whenever the burial is,
that's my question.
So the thing that's the same here is the Shiva. Because what that means is then during the Shiva, the soul is in the process of freeing itself from the body. The soul is becoming less spatial and more spiritual. Okay, and that process goes on and finally is completed by the end of Shiva. All right? As I said, that is a Kabbalistic idea which probably dates from certainly not before the end of the 13th century. Here you're 1,500 years before and what we're reading, 1,000 to 1,500 years before and what we're reading in the Talmud. So this is much later in Judaism, but you do have this idea.
I can't help but think that in a situation of conversely great joy, it takes about 7 days till you're ready to have, on the next day, the Brit
Milah. That's right. That's correct. So it's interesting that you have 7 days and the eighth day is special. The number eight is a very interesting number in Judaism. Very interesting.
Malacha for the actual day of the festival is different from the malacha of the
Cholamoid, correct.
And so there's got to be like some different point of origin, jumping off point. I'm just trying to, is there like an easy way to?
Sure, the first two chapters of this book.
What we're reading.
Yeah, the first two chapters of Moed Katan are on that subject.
Okay,
so if you get to the end of this one, go back and do the first two chapters.
Yeah, I'll answer.
Okay, back to the text. All right, now that we've established that a mourner is forbidden to work, you know what the next question is going to be. Minude, mahu ba'asiyat ha-melacha? Right? How about somebody who was under a ban? Is that person prohibited from working? Amar Rav Yosef Tashma. Rav Yosef says, come in here. And a baraita will come. Tashma is an introduction to a baraita. Kisham ru'asur ba'asiyat melacha. This is the same baraita we've read about before from Tanit, which is to say, you remember when there was a serious drought? There were a series of fasts. Right? At the end of that fast, we go into high gear, and we go into a mode that's akin to mourning. Right? So it says, Kisha amru asur ba'asiyat melacha. At that point, you have to start, you have to stop doing melacha. Lo amru ela bayom. When we say, in the case of the fast for the communal lack of rain, when you get to that case and you have to start instituting the prohibition on labor, lo amru ela bayom. This is only labor that is prohibited during the daytime. Aval balayla mutar. But at night it is prohibited. It is permissible. V'chein ata motzei b'minudeh u'b'yavel. And similarly, you see the case in a minudeh, somebody under a ban, and somebody who is a mourner. Well, that would be surprising, first of all, for the last thing that we said, that a mourner, that would mean that a mourner could work at night and not in the day. That's what the Baraita just said.
Yeah.
Okay?
Work the night shift.
You work the night shift, correct. Okay?
Can we talk about what a fast was? In other words, does the fast mean 24 hours?
No, that's daytime.
It's daytime.
It's daytime fast. Daytime fast. Okay? Okay, my... Now, the Gemara goes on and says, what is this referring to? Lav akulhu. When it mentions the person under a ban or the mourner, doesn't that refer to everything? Everything that was said above, namely that it is prohibited to work. And therefore the minudeh, the person under a ban, would be prohibited to work. And then the Gemara says, no, lo. Same thing we've seen before. It says, no, it's not referring to all of the things that were above. Asha'ara. It simply says that in certain things there is a similarity between the minudeh, the avel, and the person who is observing this strict fast. Okay? All right. Now, the Gemara will go a little bit further. It tried to learn something from the Baraita about the fast. And now it has another baraita. Tashma. Minu de shone v'shonin lo. We actually saw this when we were reading about the study of Torah. A minu de, somebody who is under a ban, can study and they teach him. They study to him, which means that he can be taught. Niskar v'niskarin lo. He may be hired, and others may be hired to work for him. Oh. So if he may be hired, and the Baraita specifically says that he may be hired, obviously he's permitted to work. Therefore, the Gemara says, Shmamina. We learn from that. Okay, Shmamina. In fact, the minudeh is permitted to work. The mourner is not permitted to work. The one under a ban is permitted to work.
We already learned that Rav said that the Merudeh can sell the water at Aravot.
That's correct. Exactly. That's correct. All right, now the third category that we have to clarify is the Mitzara. Mahu ba'asiyat melacha? is this Matzora permitted to work? And the Gemara says, Teiku. We don't know the answer to that. Right, we don't know the answer.
I think the translation is don't go there.
Don't quote them.
Maybe you cannot work.
Okay.
They will get a Rosetta Stone in which they'll.
Okay. Right. Now we go to the next one, which is Av Avel Asur Berchitza. A mourner is forbidden to bathe. Bathing is prohibited of the mourner. Okay. Dichtiv, as it is written. Here, if you remember, this was the verse in Ezekiel. This is the verse in 2 Samuel, remember, where Yoav wants to go and hire a lady from Tekoa. And she's going to be acting as a mourner, and she's going to go see King David. Okay? Isha Chachama, exactly. Isha Chachama, that's what it was about. And we saw that she had unkempt clothes, and that way we learned that you're not allowed to wash your clothes. Right? That's what we learned from that. And there it says, Al Tasuchi Shemen. Yoav says to the Isha Chachama, to the wise lady, he says to her, Dun, you're supposed to pretend to be a mourner, right? Wear garments of mourning and do not anoint yourself with oil. Al tasuchi shemen. Now what that means is to put on cosmetics. Right? You're not allowed to put on cosmetics. And the Gemara learns from that. Let me just see if I can. I didn't bring my magnifying glass today. Al tasuchi shemen. The Rashi in the manuscript says, Yoav Kach amar litakoit richitza urichitza. The Gemara goes on and says, "Bichlal sicha." Washing, namely washing the body, is considered to be a part of sicha. When we have a prohibition of sicha, of anointing, for then, I mean, it was like you hear about, what was it, Louis XIV, who never took a bath. What did he do?
Perfume.
He used perfume. That's the thing. So perfume was obviously used in the ancient world to cleanse the body. Right?
It used after bathing.
It was also used instead of bathing.
Yeah.
Because first of all, it's not so easy to... Where are you going to bathe? You don't have that much water.
I don't think the perfume was to clean. I think it was to mask.
Yeah. To mask, yeah. Exactly. But there, that's why it's all part of the same continuum here. It's all part of this thing. There's a sensitivity to the things that come out from the body that are unpleasant. And therefore, al-pasuchi includes rechitza. It includes the idea of washing the body.
Well,
you're not only punishing the person, you're punishing everybody around.
Well, that's correct. To some extent, that's correct.
But everybody becomes a
but
mourner.
You have to think about this.
Everybody knows you're a mourner. No, I'm serious. I mean, we talk about pheromones and all sorts of interesting communication through smell. I mean, so your smell is one of your most primitive ways of sensing the world, and it's a very powerful one and very emotive.
Mm-hmm.
So you would literally know immediately that you're dealing with a mourner.
Yes. In truth, that is positive to us. That in fact...
Yeah.
To communicate, there are certain times when it is permissible to communicate neglect of self. Not usually. We don't usually permit that. To the contrary, we encourage the opposite. We encourage cleanliness. I'm just working on a paper that came out of one of my Divrei Torah last year in Ur Zarua about hand washing. Remember I gave a our Torah once on Netilat Yadayim. And so I just started to work on that. I think I'm going to give that next year at the American Academy of Religion. And I'm interested again in water, in the symbolism of water. And this is in a session that is the transformation of public ritual to private ritual. That's what I'm going to be dealing with. That's the subject of the session in Judaism and in Hinduism. Transformation of public ritual to private ritual. So what I want to deal with is washing, because in the temple, it's all public. It's public ritual. It's all public stuff. And then it becomes, in Judaism, private washing. There are a variety of private obligatory washings. So it's transformation from public to private. But that's a Jewish thing. We require washing of the hands. It's a fascinating thing. You know, that's, they say, part of the reason why the Jews didn't get the Black Death, and why there were pogroms during that period of time, because it was clear that Jews didn't catch disease the way others did, because they had rules of cleanliness.
It goes back to Goshen.
Right.
I'm with all the professors, but my professor of bacteriology in college, who was Christian, credited the Jews with being the first public people to observe public health.
That's true. I mean, as far as I know, is that true, Mary? Right.
Oh yeah. I mean, I think the Goshen, you know, image is a very powerful one, that they were spared a number of the illnesses,
plagues.
The plagues, but mm-hmm. the ones that related to illness, mm-hmm. and specifically, and the traditional interpretation, I guess, is that they had a much higher level of sanitation expectation, which obviously is before the public ritual or the private one, mm-hmm. but it's whatever, it was clearly very different.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Glazer wrote that article attributing it to cleaning the house annually so carefully
for Pesach.
He's head of medicine at NYU.
Is that right?
The moldy house.
Yeah. The moldy house, that's true.
The concept.
Correct, the concept of the moldy house.
Is a transmitter of something, impurity at a minimum, but perhaps illness as well.
Correct. Very interesting. Okay. So the mourner is prohibited to bathe. Minudeh mahu birchitza. Okay, now we move on to the minudeh, to the person under a ban. Amar Rav Yosef, tashma. Rav Yosef says, come and hear a brayta. Kishamru asu birchitza. We're back to the public fast. This is another piece of the brayta about the public fast. Okay, when it says that people at that point in time in the public fast may not wash, lo amru ela kol gufo, that was directed at the entire body. Aval panav yadav raglav mutar, and that's true for the mourner as well. Well, by the way, that you could wash the hands, the face, and the feet. That's to say, hygienic cleaning is always permissible. Wherever we prohibit washing, those things are always permissible. Okay? Then it goes on, v'chein atamotze b'minudeh u'be'avel. And, again, it's the same kind of baraita. And so it is true regarding the minudeh and the mourner. And then the Gemara goes on exactly the same as before. My, what's the force of that last piece which says, so it is true also for the mourner and for the minudeh. Lava kulo. Doesn't that refer to everything? Namely, that they are identical in each of their observances, and therefore we can learn from the minudeh that a minudeh is also prohibited to bathe. And the answer is lo, asha ara, only on some of the things. It's not meant as a sweeping statement comparing the three in all cases. It simply is that in some, what you see in the baraita, you're not seeing the whole baraita here. And it's in some cases, but not in others. And in mitzora, mahu birchitza, what about the mitzora and bathing? The answer is teku. And of course, since we didn't come to a conclusion about the minudeh, the answer is also teku in effect. Okay, so we don't know the law for either the minudeh or the mitzvah.
I would think that since the minudeh can work, that they would also be able to bathe, so mm-hmm. that they work.
Happens to be the law. The laws about the minudeh, in most cases, it's like the law of the mourner. It's when you come to a case where it's not decided, you take the lenient opinion. it's the lenient opinion that prevails. Except if it were being decided today, probably. But in all the classical sources, it was the lenient opinion. Okay? Okay, now we go to the next one. Avel asur bin ilata sandal. A mourner is forbidden to wear shoes. And that's another thing that you have to keep in mind. And it's a very common sign of mourning when you see somebody who's mourning, is that they don't wear shoes. The way that that is commonly observed is to wear slippers. A mourner wears slippers. A mourner may be in stocking feet. It depends. It depends. If the mourner goes outside, the mourner can put on shoes. But we're assuming here that the mourner is staying at home. During the time that the mourner is at home, the mourner does not wear regular shoes. Okay? There are those who begin that practice when the mourner returns from the cemetery. I have been at funerals where the mourner begins immediately after the grave is filled. The grave is filled, and then the mourner immediately changes shoes at that moment, at the moment when the grave is filled, because that's when Shiva begins. Shiva begins when the grave is filled. Okay? And therefore it can happen at that time. So I've seen it both ways. All right, now why? Since God says to Ezekiel, Uni alecha tasim beraglecha, remember Ezekiel was told that he was going to have to, things were going to be so bad that he wouldn't be able to mourn the way a mourner normally would mourn when his wife was going to die, okay? That he wouldn't be able to do it. And it says to him, Uni alecha tasim beraglecha, you will put shoes on your feet. You will put shoes on your feet. Now, of course, a na'al to him probably meant a sandal. So then shoes are a little too strong for what it probably means. It probably means a sandal. Okay? Una'alecha tasim baraglecha. Michlal dekuli ama asur. It follows then that everybody else is prohibited to wear shoes on their feet. Right? He's saying you have to wear it. Everybody else, obviously, therefore, doesn't wear it. So we learn what the common custom is. Minude mahu bin ilata sandal. How about a minude? Is a minude allowed to wear shoes? Amar Rav Yosef Tashma. Here we go again. Kish amru asur bin ilata sandal regarding the public fast. When we say that at that point in time you're no longer allowed to wear any shoes on your feet, lo amru ela ba'ir, that was said only in the city. Aval bederech mutar. But if a person is on the road, he can wear shoes. Haketzad, what do you mean? Yatzala derech no'el. When he goes out on the road, he puts on his shoes. Nichnas la'ir choletz. When he comes into the city, he takes his shoes off. It's interesting. That was the, I mean, you can imagine in that world, it was the road that really was where you needed your shoes. And so, in fact, you wore them when you had to. V'chein eta motzei b'menudeh u'b'avel. And likewise, you find regarding the minudeh and the mourner. But you know the problem with this argument by now. All right. My same gemara. What does that mean? How far does that extend? Lava kulu? Doesn't that mean that they're the same in all of their practices? Love al sha'ara. No, it only applies to other things. Doesn't apply to the one we're focused on now. Mitzora. How about the Mitzora? Mahubini ilata sandal. What is the law of the Mitzora as far as wearing shoes go? Teku. We don't know. Okay? Questions still here? Yes.
I would assume that shoes is misleading. Leather footwear would be more suitable.
Yes and no, because the problem with that formulation is that people tend to think of it as if it's the same as the laws of Yom Kippur, right? And it's not, because let's say you have a pair of leather slippers. You could wear them. You could wear leather slippers. These days, what is frequently you'll see people won't do it, because the categories have become conflated. But they were not ever that way before. That wasn't the way it started. But you could, in theory, wear slippers.
The part about wearing shoes on the road and not in the city.
Right.
The roads were not as paved.
Sure.
As the city. So in the city, it was would have been not as difficult
right.
to walk around in slippers. While on the road, with a far rougher road.
Exactly.
So the quote, shoes unquote, were more necessary.
Exactly.
Just a personal question. What's the rule for the matzeva after the pura? What time it has to be the matzeva?
Anywhere, some say from a week on, some say from a month on. Our custom is about 11 months at the end of the recitation of Kaddish, but it can be done before that. The Israelis do it, and the reason that they do it is what I told you before. The custom of putting up a matzeva at the end of Shiva is because a matzeva is the headstone. The reason why that is the custom in, I believe it's a custom in Jerusalem, is what I said to you earlier. Because the soul has left the body by the end of Shiva, and therefore you put the stone up. That's the source. It's a Kabbalistic custom, and that's the reason for it.
In Jerusalem, maybe it's on the seventh day or the eighth
yeah.
day, but overall Jerusalem, I think that they do it by the 30th.
Yes, generally in Israel, it's done by the 30th day. Whereas it's not done in this country like that. This country, it's done usually about 11 months. But it could be done any time before. There's no law in this area. Okay?
Just a little question about
yes.
the sandal. Is that not biblical? Is that from Greek? Because that's sandal. I mean,
that's in the Bible.
That's the Bible.
It's a Bible sandal. So that comes into English and probably all the languages from the Hebrew. Hebrew is a source of it.
I'm a little confused about what is this, a slipper? I mean, because a sandal is sort of like our slipper now.
It depends on how you use it.
So that's what I'm saying. What did they mean by a slipper?
It meant what you... Well, they didn't say slipper. I said slipper.
Uh-huh.
They said sandal because for them, they didn't have the luxury of a shoe for this occasion and a shoe for that occasion. They had one shoe.
Right.
And
one
if you were exactly well, I mean one for each foot. But I think that what they intended was to be barefoot.
Barefoot, okay.
They intended to be barefoot.
Our interpretation is a slipper is the equivalent.
Correct, correct, okay. correct. That's the way we've come to interpret it. Okay, next one. Next one, very interesting. They're all interesting. This one's particularly interesting. Avel asur betashmish amita. The mourner is prohibited to have sexual relations. Okay, there are a variety of situations where sexual relations are prohibited. Among them is a case of mourning. All right? And here, look, there's a scriptural source for this. Dichtiv, as it is written, and this is in the book of 2 Samuel. Vayinachem David et Batsheva ishto vayavo eleha. And David comforted his wife Bathsheba, and he came into her and lay with her. Vayishkabita. Nichlal b'meikara asur. Therefore, you can see that since the Bible says that after he had comforted her, he lay with her. Therefore, it follows that before that, he didn't. Okay? That is then the scriptural source. Now, I want to read to you, to refamiliarize you with this scriptural source. It's a very, very interesting source. And halachically, it's a somewhat problematic source, but it's a very important story, and I want to be sure that you know the story. This is starts in the 11th chapter of the book of 2 Samuel. And this is the story of David and Bathsheba. At the turn of the year, the season when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab, who we've already seen. We've already had contact with this guy, Joab, with his officers and all Israel with him, and they devastated Ammon and besieged Rabbah. Now, you know what Ammon and Rabbah is. Rabbat Ammon. Rabbat Ammon is Jordan. Okay, there they were fighting the Ammonites who were living distance in Jordan. Yarden, of course, there was no country Jordan until very recently. Late one afternoon, David rose from his couch and strolled on the roof of the royal palace. And from the roof he saw a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful, and the king sent someone to make inquiries about the woman. He reported, "She is Bathsheba, daughter of Eliam, and wife of Uriah the Hittite." David sent messengers to fetch her. She came to him, and he lay with her. She had just purified herself after her period, and she went back home. Now, this is the Bible. This is very interesting. This is your kink. Right? This is good old King David.
And was she Jewish?
No. Well, we don't know. I mean, she had a Hittite husband. But you think that was the issue? That's what you're interested in here?
No, so that's why I'm questioning why he was not so observant of the halakha.
You noticed?
You heard her talk about it?
The woman conceived, and she sent word to David. She ends up getting pregnant.
But we're to assume she's had no relations with her own husband.
He's on the front.
Tell us that. We know that. Okay, fine.
She sends word to King David and says, "I am pregnant." Thereupon David sent a message to Joab, "Send Uriah the Hittite to me." And Joab sent Uriah to David. When Uriah came to him, David asked him how Joab and the troops were faring and how the war was going. Then David said to Uriah, "Go down to your house and bathe your feet." I'm sure that's a way of saying what he wanted him to do was to go home and sleep with his wife. Because then it would have been unclear who was the source, who was the father. Okay. When Uriah left the royal palace, a present from the king followed him, a group of people probably. But Uriah slept at the entrance of the royal palace, along with the other officers of his lord, and did not go down to his house. When David was told that Uriah had not gone down to his house, he said to Uriah, "You just came from a journey. Why didn't you go down to your house?" All right, so we know he was away. Uriah answered David, "The ark and Israel and Judah are located at Sukkot, and my master Joab and your majesty's men are camped in the open. How can I go home and eat and drink and sleep with my wife?" This is such a good guy. I mean, this is a wonderful man.
But he commanded him.
All right? Everybody is in a state of high alert here. The ark is not home. The army is at battle. And, you know, I'm one of them. I'm in the army.
Alert red.
Okay? David said to Uriah, "Stay here today also, and tomorrow I will send you off." So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day. The next day David summoned him, and he ate and drank with him until he got him drunk. But in the evening Uriah went out to sleep in the same place.
Oh, no.
He finally got him drunk, he goes to sleep with his wife. Right? No luck. He went out to sleep in the same place. This is the good book. That's the Bible. It tells you everything the way it is, okay? talk about what our speaker said the other night of learning morals from the Bible, right? But the Bible teaches it in an interesting way. All right, he goes out to sleep in the same place with his Lord's officers. He did not go down to his home. Right, that's the force. In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab, which he sent with Uriah. He wrote in the letter as follows: place Uriah in the front line where the fighting is fiercest, then fall back so that he may be killed. That's the letter. So when Joab was besieging the city, he stationed Uriah at the point where he knew that there were able warriors. The men of the city sallied out and attacked Joab, and some of David's officers among the troops fell. Uriah the Hittite was among those who died. Joab sent a full report of the battle to David. He instructed the messenger as follows: when you finish reporting to the king all about the battle, the king may get angry and say to you, why did you come so close to the city to attack it? Didn't you know that they would shoot from the wall? Who struck down Abimelech, son of Yerubbeshet? Was it not a woman who dropped in an upper millstone on him from the wall at Tebez, from which he died? Why did you come so close to the wall? Then say, your servant Uriah the Hittite was among those killed. The messenger set out. He came and told David all that Joab had said to him, had sent him to say. The messenger said to David, first the men prevailed against us and sallied out against us into the open. Then we drove them back to the entrance to the gate. But the archers shot at your men from the wall, and some of your majesty's men fell. Your servant Uriah the Hittite also fell. Whereupon David said to the messenger, give Joab this message. Do not be distressed about the matter. The sword always takes its toll. What a line. The sword always takes its toll.
That's how you become a king.
Oh, boy. Press your attack on the city and destroy it. Encourage him. When Uriah's wife heard that her husband Uriah was dead, she lamented over her husband. After the period of mourning was over, obviously there was a period of mourning there, David sent and had her brought into his palace. She became his wife, and she bore him a son. Chapter 12. But the Lord was displeased with what David had done. Okay? And the Lord sent Nathan to David. He came to him and said, there were two men in the same city, one rich and one poor. The rich man had very large flocks and herds, but the poor man had only one little ewe lamb that he had bought. He tended it, and it grew up together with him and his children. It used to share his morsel of bread, drink from his cup, and nestle in his bosom. It was like a daughter to him. One day a traveler came to the rich man, but he was loath to take anything from his own flocks or herds to prepare a meal for the guest who had come to him. So he took the poor man's lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him. David flew into a rage against the man and said to Nathan, as the Lord lives, the man who did this deserves to die. He shall pay for the lamb four times over because he did such a thing and showed no pity. And Nathan said to David, that man is you. Thus said the Lord, the God of Israel, it was I who anointed you king over Israel, and it was I who rescued you from the hand of Saul. I gave you your master's house and possession of your master's wives, and I gave you the house of Israel and Judah, and if that were not enough, I would give you twice as much more. Why then have you flouted the command of the Lord and done what displeases him? You have put Uriah the Hittite to the sword. You took his wife and made her your wife and had him killed by the sword of the Ammonites. Therefore the sword shall never depart from your house. because you spurned me by taking the wife of Uriah the Hittite and making her your wife. Thus said the Lord, I will make a calamity rise against you from within your house. I will take your wives and give them to another man before your very eyes, and he shall sleep with your wives under this very sun. You acted in secret, but I will make this happen in the sight of all Israel and in broad daylight. David said to Nathan, I stand guilty before the Lord. And Nathan replied to David, the Lord has remitted your sin. Right? He does tshuva. You shall not die. However, since you have spurned the enemies of the Lord by this deed, even the child about to be born to you shall die. Nathan went home, and the Lord afflicted the child that Uriah's wife had borne to David, and it became critically ill. David entreated God for the boy. David fasted, and he went in and spent the night lying on the ground. The senior servants of his household tried to induce him to get up from the ground, but he refused, nor would he partake of food with them. On the seventh day, the child died. David's servants were afraid to tell David that the child was dead. For they said, we spoke to him when the child was alive and he wouldn't listen to us. How can we tell him that the child is dead? He might do something terrible. When David saw his servants talking in whispers, David understood that the child was dead. David asked his servants, is the child dead? Yes, they replied. Thereupon David rose from the ground. He bathed and anointed himself, and he changed his clothes. He went into the house of the Lord, and he prostrated himself. Then he went home and asked for food which they set before him, and he ate. His courtiers asked him, why have you acted in this manner? While the child was alive, you fasted and wept. But now that the child is dead, you rise and take food? He replied, while the child was still alive, I fasted and wept because I thought, who knows? The Lord may have pity on me, and the child may live. But now that he is dead, why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? Shall I go to him, but he will never come back to me? Next paragraph. Vayinachem David et Bathsheba. And David consoled his wife Bathsheba. He went to her.
I'm sorry.
David consoled his wife Bathsheba. He went to her and lay with her. She bore a son, and she named him Solomon. The Lord favored him, and he sent a message through the prophet Nathan, and he was named Yedidya at the instance of the Lord.
Wow.
That's the story of David and Bathsheba.
Wow.
It's a story that you will see in art. It is a story in music. It is one of the great and terrifying and attractive and repulsive biblical stories. And of course, after David, of course, the whole David's personal life is a disaster. It's downhill from here. His personal life is a disaster, his rebellion and his sons, and eventually the kingdom effectively falls apart in the next generation. So he's paid back for his lust and his indiscretion. But that is where, I mean, this is a story that is so laced with sex. In adultery. I mean, it's a payback for adultery and for murder. Yeah. Both of them. It's a murder. He murders Uriah. He commits adultery first, then he murders Uriah. And
it's the cover-up.
What's the status of the child, too?
What's the status of the child? Again, if it were a question of Jewish law, it would not be good for this child. I can't really tell you exactly what the facts were in that case, because this child came to an ignominious end anyway, and the child died.
That was another curse.
All right? So that's part of the terrible nature of this story. Wait, hold on a second. So it is from here that we derive the law, just at the end of this story, that he consoles his wife, the assumption being, of course, what we are seeing again is a conflation of times and of customs. Whether this is what's meant, that there was a Shiva period following that, it's not at all clear. It is clear that there was a period of consolation. There was some consolation involved, and I assume that that's what is implied by that. And of course, then he does come to have relations with his wife. But of course, in the original, there are so many other layers to this. You know, this was the child who died because of his action and so on, so that the psychological pain of the whole thing, the murder involved, is so complex and so devastating, really. But it's at the end of that consolation then that they reinitiate the relations. And that, therefore, is the law. That is the law. Now, of course, in it's not a very hard law to understand. It's a time when in many ways, a person is given space to draw into himself. And you don't talk to other people. Remember, we talked about Shela Shalom, right? You don't entertain people. You don't talk to people. You are just allowed and given the space for withdrawal. And that space also involves sexual withdrawal. I know the argument some people have made, well, what if it was a source of comfort? I think that the feeling here is that it's more likely to be an imposition, and that just the whole thing should be avoided.
Side question to the story. Ratzachta v'gam yarashta, it's coming from the story. Okay. That's the source. Okay.
How is Christian theologian treat the David story? Because they claim that Jesus is coming from David.
I have no license to teach that. I don't know the answer.
As you read it, it struck me though that because of the timing of when he visits Bathsheba again, they're saying that because the child didn't live long enough, there's no mourning.
There is no mourning until 3 months, I said.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know how to tell the child.
All of that is possible.
We do. But I thought it was the child died after 7 days.
Yes, we see the child died after 7 days. Keep in mind now. One of the things that this raises, as we've raised it several times now, is the antiquity of these practices. You know, can we learn from this that such a practice is biblical in origin? And we've raised this several times with the laws of mourning. Are the laws of mourning d'oraita, from the Torah? Or are they d'rabbanan, from the rabbis? There's much commentary on this section because it appears as if this is at least biblical. But that's not clear whether you can say that it's from the Torah, though. Because this may be that as the law develops, it develops by, you know, a later period in time. This is the law of the prophets, and the prophets are the earliest layer of what we will later come to understand as the oral law. Okay?
The child was not 7 days old. It was the seventh day of the illness.
Correct. Seventh day of the illness, correct.
It seems that the source text for a lot of this stuff is not the Torah, but The Navi.
Correct. That is why this is problematic. And eventually we'll look at what the commentators say about that. But I'm just reacting to what seems obvious from the text. You've got Amos, you've got Ezekiel. But we also do have Torah sources. It's not as if we don't have any Torah sources. But that's why it's not a slam dunk. It's not obviously clear from what we're reading.
If we do not know whether Bathsheba was Jewish or not, then how do we know that Solomon was Jewish?
Because if that were a problem, mm-hmm. she was surely converted before she married him. Mm. Okay? Okay? Now, because she was conceived, yeah, well, Solomon was followed the marriage. So if any of that is relevant, that would be the relevant answer.
There's no record for people.
I'm telling you, I'm not sure that any of it is relevant to the facts. But if it is, that would be the answer.
And so many instances of teiku here. I mean, what is that implying about what was happening at the time in terms of these? I mean, these don't seem to be circumstances that didn't arise.
The teikus are, now that realize the teikus are all in connection to the Midnudeh yes. and the Mitzorah,
right.
more for the Midnudeh than the Mitzorah. Right. I think it's a result of the artificial construction, the literary construction of this whole section of the Talmud. Because it's constructed as a tripartite construct, it works and it doesn't work. And what we are seeing is the doesn't work side of it, plus the fact that we have these complicating baraitot. We do have a tradition of baraitot, obviously, that are connected with the fasting. And you see the rabbis trying to flesh out the words of that baraita to see whether they are identical in all of their details or not. And what we're getting from here is that it must have been the tradition that they were not identical.
But does it suggest that the practice at the time was simply split and that some people did it one way and some people another?
Well, there are a few possibilities. The answer is yes or no. But we have no proof. You know, we just don't know the answer to it. And I want to finish up just a little bit further. A little bit further. Because I want you to see the other ones. Minudeh. Mahu betashmish amita. Okay? Let's see what the minudeh is. The person who's under a ban. Amar Rav Yosef. Tashma. Kol otan shanim shayu Yisrael bamidbar. Minudim ayu. All the time that Israel was in the wilderness, they were under a ban. We learned that, right? From the time that the people were cursed to wander for 40 years, they were effectively under God's ban. Right? They didn't listen to the rabbi, who was God.
As it were.
Okay?
It's a right? Land of Israel.
Vishimshu mitotehem. But we know that they had sex during that period of time. Okay? How do we know that they had sex? Exactly. We have
600,000 warriors.
Because we have the census that is done at several different times. And even though we know from the biblical story that a lot of people died in plagues, in punishments, in wars, and undoubtedly because they died of old age too, or illness, still we see that the numbers remain constant. Only one way that could have happened. Okay? V'shimshum mitotehem. Amal ha'abaye v'dilmen minudeh l'shamayim shaleh. Maybe somebody who is under a ban from heaven is in a different situation. And here it says, bekil. It's more lenient. Now, do you remember the last time we saw this argument? It was somebody who was in a ban from heaven, but a ban from heaven was more stringent the last time we saw this brought up. What was it? I don't remember what the specifics escapes me for the moment. What was the context of that? Okay. V'ha'amart chamir. So then the Gemara says, but the last time you said the ban from heaven was more stringent. Okay? Now you're saying the ban from heaven is more lenient. Last time you said it was more stringent. Sapuki mesapkala. Abayo, who mentioned it, must have been unsure about which way a ban of heaven works. Okay? Zil hacha, if you go to one place, kamarchele, he rejects the possibility he doesn't want. Zil hacha, you go to the other one, kamarchele, and he rejects the other possibility. So he seems to use this, it always works for whatever purpose he has. All right? So that's the end of the discussion. I come to no conclusion about the minudeh. And of course, the answer is that the minudeh is permitted to have sexual relations. Okay? Which then brings us to the last one, the mitzora.
Unless his wife of the mitzora.
And I'd say it's actually an issue. That's mentioned in the commentary here. The question is, a minudeh's required to give distance to people. So the commentators said, well, maybe that means his wife. And that's not the case because we have a principle, ishto kagufo. Right? A man's wife is like himself. And therefore, you don't have to have the distance. What?
Does she become a menuda?
No, she doesn't. But as far as sex goes, she can still get it. Right. So remember, in sex, a woman has the right to demand. It's not, it doesn't work the other way around because she's the one who would be in the mitzvah is that she has to get the sex. Not that he has to get it, but that she has to get it. She has the right to sex.
Onata.
All right? Onata, right. And I don't want to go into that now, but I want to finish this up with the Metzora. Metzora, ma hu betashmish amita. What about the Metzora and his sex? Tashma, the Tanya. And there's a Baraita that says, V'yashav michutz li'o'alo. He shall dwell outside of his tent for 7 days. This is talking about a Metzora. Metzora has to dwell outside of his tent for 7 days. Vas shiyehe kiminude ucha avel. And he will be like a minude and an avel. Vasur betashmisha mita. And he is forbidden to have relations. This is the Metzora. Metzora. I ve'en ohalo ele ishto. When it says that he had to dwell outside his tent, that means outside his wife. The tent is the metaphor for wife. Okay. Alright, Shenamar Lech Emor Lahem Shuva Lechem La'olechem. This is after the revelation. It says that, you know, there was a period when they had to be separate from their wives, the revelation at Mount Sinai. After that it says, go back into your tents. That means that you commit that you can have relations with your wives again. Okay? Oh, so then Shmamina. We now know the law as far as the Metzora goes. A Metzora cannot have relations. And there we had raised before also the medical side of it. It's interesting that it's consistent here. That the Metzora has...
But it's a teiku with him bathing. You'd think if it's a whole medical thing, the Metzora would... It wouldn't be a teiku. He should bathe.
Or he shouldn't. For contagion in the water.
Maybe it's a public bath.
I leave it for you guys to argue. There's one thing that's a problem here, though. Realize what we just said. The nif shot nami liminude. The Baraita just said, like a minude and like an avel. So maybe we learn from this also that a minude cannot have sexual relations. All right? Amar Rav Huna Bereda Rav Pinchas Mishmeda Rav Yosef Mikatani Asur. Does it say that this person is forbidden, that the minudeh is forbidden to have relations? It just says, again, that there are some things that are alike and some things that are not alike. We're back to where we were the last time, in a way. It's a slightly different formulation, but it has the same force. So, in other words, there are, you can't really learn from the fact that these three are put together in one baraita that they are identical in all cases. But what we can learn is that we did learn from the baraita that it specifically says that the Metzora cannot have sex with his wife.
Didn't it say outside the tent for 7 days?
Yes.
So does that mean for 7 days they can't have sexual relations?
That's an interesting argument.
And
in
the same thing for Shiva for 7 days?
Correct, correct.
It says days, not nights.
But you see, the way they're using this, realize the way they are using this as a proof text. Whether it says that or not, it doesn't really matter. They're either using it as a proof text because they know what the law is already, or in fact, in, to their mind, this was a decent proof text. I can't say anything more about it than that.
I wanted to go back to the King David story for eating. Is the King David story taken as a part of the reason why you don't fast? You know, it's very specific about him having a meal.
Yes. That can be learned, but it's not a matter of law. It's not a matter of law, but can be learned from the story.
I mean, you would think that the natural inclination of would be some to fast. People would be to fast.
Correct.
And yet
correct.
We do exactly
we
the
don't
opposite.
Do it. We don't do it. We have a mourner's meal, mm-hmm. when you come from the cemetery, which is exactly the opposite, correct?
And the way that story is told, it sounds like there was real emphasis in the story
correct.
On the fact that...
Correct.
The prior mentioning of the heavenly ban was on 15A3 regarding greeting people.
Oh, that's what it was. Very good. Thank you. Thank you. To be continued.
Rabbi, Shabbos, you mentioned the four...